Part 3, Chapter 9, in which Harvey catches himself in a painting and R.T. reads a poem. Later that evening, the group was gathered at the Treehouse Lounge, listening to the stereo system Thales had just bought. Footnote. Amazingly, there was no thought given to the purchase of a television, and the residents would not own one in the 15 months they occupied the Treehouse Lounge, though they did have an antenna on the roof to give the place a modern look. Instead, they put their money into their stereos, for they were able to create their own journeys while listening to record albums, whereas television obligated them to take someone else's journey. Stanislaw Lem makes a similar observation regarding the difference between critics and authors in his book, A Perfect Vacuum. Back to the text. Thales had just bought a stereo system. While they passed around a censor, R.T. controlled the selections, and with each new song they were transported to a different time and place. Some melodies took them back to experiences of the past. Some inspired visions and fantasies of the future, and others left them suspended in the timeless smoke of the present. They moved from Tull to Traffic to Marley, and when R.T. put on some Dylan, Harvey had a feeling that this was the real stuff. Said Thales, unable to make himself heard above the music. Echoed Harvey. Continued Thales, getting a beer for each of the others and keeping a couple for himself. When the beer ran its course, the captain was drawn to the bathroom. There was a painting on the wall above the toilet, and he recognized it as Torremolinos before the tourist invasion. The artist had painted two men on the beach with their boat, repairing their nets and discussing the currents offshore. Harvey felt a twinge of pain, which he attributed to the fond memory of his times with Mahogany. But when the pain persisted, he realized he had caught his glands in his zipper. He had to look down to free himself, but after he did, he returned to the canvas and, bleeding only slightly, stepped into the frame. It was a warm afternoon, and the sun was beginning to set as Harvey approached the fishermen. To their outright amazement, he addressed them in perfect Andalusian dialect and stopped to entertain them with a series of fish tales which the older of the two, had he drunk a little less Rioja Especial in his days, would have recognized as his own. Farther up the coast, the captain passed three boys building castles with plastic buckets and shovels, and then he came to an open-air restaurant where he stopped and sat down. Footnote. Margaret Randall, Personal Correspondence, January 1, 1965, describes Torremolinos in the 50s. I remember well that village, for that's what it was in 1955, taking the trolley out from Malaga, dancing at the one or two waterfront bars that existed then, eating paella at a tiny family place in the center of town, where the owner asked what fish you'd like, then caught and baked it in a sand fire by the wooden tables. In those days, one had to walk quite a ways from the trolley to reach the village. And we had a fine house, complete with furniture, two bedrooms, outdoor shower, and enclosed patio, all for something like $10 U.S. a month. I remember we used to eat churros and chocolate at 5 o'clock in the morning. Back to the text. Harvey came to an open-air restaurant where he stopped and sat down. The shore in front of his table looked remarkably familiar, and he remembered that 28 years later he had been ravished there by the 17 drunken maenads. He could hear the conversation of a young man and woman sitting at a neighboring table. "How do you feel?" the man asked. "I feel fine," she answered. "There's nothing wrong with me. I feel fine." Harvey looked at the farmland that stretched to the sea, remembering what it would look like in the future when it was covered with cement. It was an inevitable occurrence, the spread of the population plague. Here it destroyed a fishing village, there a mountain retreat. Soon, dear reader, it will reach your home. When Harvey had eaten his fill, he took a last look up the unblemished beach, then stepped out of the painting and back into the treehouse lounge. The others were still in the living room, and R.T. asked them if they'd like to hear the poetry he'd written. For 5 weeks, R.T. had been writing a series of love poems, which he delivered anonymously. It was something he could still do in the 70s without striking fear into the heart of his muse. In fact, when he finally did reveal his identity, his Beatrice told him she was flattered by the poetry and thanked him. His friends considered the adventure a consummate performance of bad acting, and they reveled in his descriptions of midnight walks to deliver the poems. Harvey, in particular, listened as if it were he and not R.T. who had been the secret messenger of love. "Of course," said R.T., "I signed the poems with my pen name, R.T. "R.T.?" said Prometheus. "Roland Twelves," he said. "You remember, from the monument in Memory Grove." R.T. led the group into his room, and as they entered, Harvey was overwhelmed by the sea of photographs that covered the walls. They were black and white shots R.T. had taken and printed himself, and there were more than 100 on 3 of the walls, leaving only the south wall and window uncovered. There was also a large print of a 15th-century painting. But before the captain could study it, R.T. began to read. "A single obsession of light, a single smile in the soil of the soul, a flash in the shadow, a burning planet, a single note from the spheres. A single light illuminating the water's crash at the cliffs of the heart. A leaping light of statues erected and raised in the foam. An undulating light reflecting the swell and hollow and sway. A simple light persisting in absence, an extinguished star that continues." Clearly and quietly his voice carried to his listeners, and though it was evident his poems were not very good, there was something engaging in their innocent sensuality. There was taste and sight and sound. When Harvey returned to his tree, a quarter moon was climbing past Artemis and her nymphs in the sky, and she was as beautiful as the Greeks had described her. Raising his arms to embrace her, he cried out, but she did not hear him, and Harvey wondered, perhaps for the first time, if he could ever love as Mahogany had, and if he could, would she be a real woman, made of flesh and blood? Eventually, his neck grew tired, and he lowered his glance and discovered a small white flower. It was sturdy but soft, and when he brushed the edges of its petals, its resistance tickled his fingers. A generous impulse inspired him to yank it from the earth. "Per te, cara Trivia, tra le ninfe eterne," he said, offering the flower to Artemis. Translation: "For you, dear goddess, among the eternal nymphs." See Dante Paradiso, Canto 23, line 26. Back to the text. "She loves me, she loves me not," Harvey said, plucking the leaves. "She loves me, she loves me not. She loves me, she loves me not. She loves me, she loves me not. The stars and trees and all the spirits of evening waited to know the result. She loves me, she loves me not. She loves me, she loves me not." He was about to pluck the last petals when he stopped and threw the stem to the earth. I don't want a woman who's that inconstant. But Artemis had noticed Harvey, and she had a complaint to level with Aphrodite. I'm tired of this voyeuristic captain, she said. Every time I turn around or try to take a bath, he's spying from his tree. Can't you do something? As a matter of fact, said the Cytherean goddess, I've prepared a dark-eyed arrow in his Greek class.